Thursday at MediSure Insurance. Same old phones ringing, the same clatter of keyboards, and the usual groans about who'd finished their coffee first before the vending machine broke again. I was at my desk on the 30th floor, scrolling through emails, counting the hours till lunch. Nothing ever happened here. Then, he walked in. He didn't look like trouble at first, just some middle-aged guy with tired eyes, dressed in a suit that didn't quite fit him. But it was the bag that caught my eye. This huge black duffel bag slung over his shoulder looked way too heavy for just papers. He went straight to the front desk where Clara, our receptionist, greeted him with her usual overly chipper smile.
Good morning. How can I help you today?
He slammed a folder down on the desk. I need someone to look at my claim, he said, voice flat. Clara frowned as she opened the folder.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. This is something the claims department handles, but you'll need an appointment.
His tone changed so fast it made my stomach flip. An appointment? I've been waiting for months. My wife is dying, and you people can't even... He cut himself off, slamming his fist on the desk so hard the papers jumped. The whole floor went quiet. Clara, bless her, tried to keep her calm.
I understand, sir, but...
You don't understand anything! He yelled. And that's when I saw it. His hand moved to the bag, unzipping it slowly. My chest tightened. My gut screamed. This is bad. Really, really bad. He pulled out a shotgun. Everyone back! He shouted, his voice so loud it made my ears ring. Clara let out this blood-curdling scream and ran, her heels clicking against the floor. People ducked under desks or bolted for the exits. But I just froze. My hands gripped the edge of my desk so hard, my knuckles went white. The man, Carter, I heard someone whisper, climbed onto Clara's desk, the shotgun swinging back and forth like a pendulum. His face was red, veins bulging in his neck. You think you can ignore me? Push me around? Not anymore! He fired into the ceiling. Boom! Dust and chunks of plaster rained down, covering everything in this gritty white powder. The whole office went into shock. No one moved. No one even breathed. Where's your boss? Carter barked. Get him out here! Now! The silence was deafening. No one dared answer. His eyes darted around, landing on this young intern sitting near the back. She couldn't have been more than 22, fresh out of college. He grabbed her by the arm, yanking her out of the chair. Sit! He snarled, shoving her into the middle of the room. She was sobbing so hard she could barely breathe. Nobody moves or she's dead! I could barely hear anything over the blood pounding in my ears. I wanted to crawl to my phone and call for help, but it was on the desk, right out in the open. If he saw me move, I'd be next. Minutes dragged like hours. Carter was pacing now, waving the gun around, ranting about how the system is broken and insurance companies decide who lives and who dies. His voice cracked when he said, "My wife begged me to fight for her, and this is the only way you people listen!" The sirens came next. The sound was muffled at first, but when the lights outside started flashing red and blue, it hit me. The cops were here. A voice came over the intercom. Calm and steady. Mr. Carter, this is Detective Ellis with the NYPD. We want to help you. Let's talk. Carter laughed bitterly, shaking his head. Talk? You want to talk now? Where were you when I needed your help? When my wife needed help? Where were you then? He yanked the intern to her feet again, pointing the gun at her head. Her knees buckled and she let out a sob that made my heart shatter. You don't think I know how this ends? Carter growled. You'll call me crazy, a terrorist, but I'm not the bad guy here. You, the ones with riches and power, get to decide who gets to live and fucking die. His shoulders slumped. For a second, I thought he might give up. His grip on the shotgun loosened, and his head dropped. That's when I saw it, the red laser dot on his chest. The shot rang out, louder than anything I'd ever heard. Carter staggered back. His eyes wide in shock, his blood blossomed across his shirt. The shotgun fell to the floor with a heavy thud. He collapsed a second later, crumpling like a puppet whose strings had been cut. The intern screamed, and officers stormed the room, pulling her to safety. The SWAT team swarmed in, guns drawn, shouting commands that I couldn't even process. I stayed under my desk, too afraid to move, too afraid to breathe. My whole body was trembling. Even after they carried Carter's body out on a stretcher, his face pale and lifeless, I couldn't make myself get up. Some nights, I wake up in cold sweat, the echo of that gunshot ringing in my ears, and Carter's voice whispering over and over, "You think you're safe?" The protagonist of the story is a fictional character based on 26-year-old Luigi Mangione, an Ivy League graduate. He's accused of fatally shooting UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in Midtown Manhattan on December 4th, 2024. Allegedly motivated by anger toward the healthcare industry, Mangione was arrested in Altoona, Pennsylvania, 5 days later, found with a 3D-printed gun, silencer, and a manifesto criticizing the U.S. healthcare system. He faces multiple state and federal charges, including murder as an act of terrorism, and has pleaded not guilty. The case has sparked debates over the idolization of alleged criminals and the potential influence of public opinion on legal proceedings. I was never someone who enjoyed parties. Being an introverted and socially awkward guy has always been a problem around this time of year. Parties were winding down and the streets were mostly empty. Our house was no different. Maddie and Kaylee had gone out earlier and returned sometime after 1:30 a.m., their laughter echoing faintly through the walls. Xana and Ethan came back shortly after, their voices mixing with the sound of the TV upstairs. I stayed downstairs, tucked away in my small room, scrolling through my phone and trying to ignore the world above me. By 2 a.m., the house fell silent. It wasn't unusual. We all had our own routines. I thought I'd drift off to sleep, but then a noise broke the quiet. A muffled thud, followed by another. I froze, my ears straining. It didn't sound like someone stumbling or dropping something. It was heavier, deliberate. My mouth went dry. Maybe it was nothing, I told myself. Still, my chest tightened as I got up to check. I told myself I was just thirsty. As I opened my door, the air felt strange, heavy and cold, like the house was holding its breath. I crept into the kitchen, my bare feet barely making a sound on the hardwood floor. That's when I saw him. At first, I thought it was Ethan. The build was similar, broad shoulders, average height. But then I noticed the mask, black, smooth, and featureless. My breath hitched. He moved slowly, purposefully, a long knife glinting in his hand. The faint moonlight from the window caught the blade, making it shimmer like a predator's tooth. I ducked behind the kitchen counter, my heart pounding so loud I was sure he'd hear it. I peeked over the edge just as he slipped into Maddie's room. The door clicked shut behind him. I waited, my muscles stiff with fear. The silence stretched on, unbearable. Then came the faintest sound, a muffled gasp, and then nothing. My stomach churned as he reappeared, the knife dripping dark streaks onto the floor. He didn't hesitate, moving to Kaylee's room next. I wanted to scream, to run, but my body refused to move. All I could do was watch. He emerged again, his movements calm and methodical, as if he'd done this a thousand times. The knife was slick with blood now, droplets trailing behind him like breadcrumbs. My chest felt like it would cave in as he turned toward Xana and Ethan's room. I crawled toward the stairs, desperate for somewhere to hide. My hands shook as I ducked behind a tall vase, pressing myself against the wall, praying he wouldn't notice me. Through the crack in the door, I saw him push into their room. Xana's voice broke the stillness.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, her voice trembling. Ethan stirred, his groggy voice barely audible. The man didn't answer. He lunged. The knife plunged into Ethan's chest with a sickening crunch. Xana screamed, but it didn't last long. The sound of her terror turned into choking gasps as blood sprayed the walls. I clamped my hand over my mouth, tears streaming down my face as I tried to stay silent. My whole body trembled as I prayed he wouldn't hear me. Then he paused. For a moment, it felt like time stopped. his head turned slightly, his cold, empty eye scanning the hallway. My heart pounded so hard that I thought it would explode. He took a step toward the vase. I held my breath, my chest burning, my vision blurring. But then, as if deciding I wasn't worth his time, he turned and walked away. The sound of his footsteps faded into the night. I stayed frozen, curled up behind the vase until the first rays of sunlight streamed through the windows. My body ached, my throat was raw, and my mind felt shattered. When I finally stumbled into the living room, it felt like stepping into a nightmare. The house was crawling with cops, the air thick with the stench of copper and bleach. Crime scene tape crisscrossed the halls. An officer noticed me and asked who I was. I stammered something, barely coherent. They guided me outside, treating me like some lost child. I sat on the curb, staring blankly as the chaos unfolded around me. I overheard snippets of conversations. No fingerprints, no signs of forced entry. Four lives were gone in an instant, and no one knew why. Weeks passed, and the whole campus felt like it was suffocating under the weight of fear. The media swarmed like vultures, spinning theories and pointing fingers. Then, in December, they arrested Brian Koberger, a criminology PhD student. The irony made me want to vomit. His car had been spotted near the house that night. His DNA matched the knife sheath left behind. But none of that erased the terror that haunted me. Even now, I can't close my eyes without seeing those cold, empty eyes staring at me. The Idaho killing case revolves around the tragic deaths of four University of Idaho students: Kaylee Goncalves, Madison Mogan, Zanna Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin, who were brutally stabbed in their off-campus home in Moscow, Idaho, on November 13, 2022. The shocking crime left the small college town on edge. After weeks of investigation, police arrested Brian Koberger, a criminology PhD student at Washington State University, in December 2022. DNA evidence, surveillance footage, and cell phone data tied Koberger to the crime. The case, still unfolding as of 2025, has drawn national attention for its disturbing nature and the ongoing legal proceedings. 1968 was supposed to be my new beginning. My family was moving to New York, and that night on the Sunset Strip was my send-off, a chance to soak in the city one last time. The neon lights flickered, music thumped in the distance, and the world felt electric. And then I saw him. He was standing by the entrance of the club, his eyes dark, scanning the crowd. He looked normal, maybe even handsome, but something about the way he lingered made my stomach churn. His name was Rodney Alcala, and he had a reputation for being smooth, maybe too smooth. "Hey," he said later, flashing a grin that didn't quite reach his eyes. "You guys should come to my place. Let's keep the party going." I didn't trust him, but my friends laughed it off. "It's just Rodney," one of them said. "He's harmless." That's how I ended up in the back seat of his car. I sat stiffly, my unease growing with every mile we put between us and the strip. The streets grew darker and quieter until we pulled up to a rundown house. Inside, the air was heavy and smelled faintly of mildew. Rodney handed around a joint, and my friends accepted without hesitation. I, on the other hand, couldn't relax. Rodney's gaze kept darting to me, his smile fading into something colder, hungrier. I should have left. I should have listened to my instincts. "Come with me," Rodney said, suddenly grabbing my arm.
"What?"
I asked, my voice trembling. "Come on," he said, his tone now sharp, his grip unrelenting. He yanked me down the hall, shoving open a door and pulling me into a dimly lit bedroom.
"Let me go!"
I screamed, trying to pull free.
"Shut up!"
he snapped, slamming the door behind us. He took off his belt, wrapping it around his fist.
"You think you can just leave?"
he hissed, his voice low and venomous. My heart pounded.
"Please, I..."
Before I could finish, his fist connected with my face. Pain exploded between my eyes as my head hit the wall. I crumpled to the floor, dazed but still conscious. Rodney knelt over me, his breath hot and sour.
You're not going anywhere,
he whispered, his voice almost amused. He pulled out a knife, the blade catching the dim light. My breath caught as he cut the tie of my blouse, the fabric fading away to reveal a thin red line across my chest. I thought for sure he did cut my throat. All I thought inside my head was,
did he really cut me? Will I die?
You're gonna die here, he said, casually, like he was discussing the weather. No one will ever find you. Tears streamed down my face as I struggled against him, but he shoved his belt into my mouth, gagging me. I gagged and thrashed, but he tied my wrists with a necktie, his motions quick and practiced.
Stop moving!
He growled, punching me in the stomach. The air rushed from my lungs, and I collapsed, gasping. Rodney was out of control now, his face red and twisted with rage.
This is your fault!
He spat, cutting away the rest of my clothes.
You shouldn't have gotten in the car!
I wanted to scream, to beg for mercy, but I couldn't. My vision blurred, my chest heaved, and I felt myself slipping away. After some point, I wanted it to end. I didn't want to live. I wanted to die. Then, suddenly, there was a loud pounding on the door.
Rodney!
Someone shouted.
Open the door!
It was my friends. Rodney froze, his head snapping toward the noise. His hands tightened on the knife, and for a terrified moment, I thought he was going to finish it anyway. The pounding grew louder.
Mike, break the window!
The glass shattered, and Mike burst into the room, his eyes wide with horror. He froze for a moment, staring at Rodney, who stood over me, blood staining his shirt. Rodney stepped back, his expression blank. Take her, he said, his voice eerily calm. Mike didn't hesitate. He grabbed me and pulled me through the broken window. My legs were weak, my body trembling, but I clung to him as we stumbled into the night. Outside, the air felt cold and sharp, like I could finally breathe again. A car screeched to a halt nearby, and the couple inside helped us escape. Rodney didn't follow. Mike took me to his apartment, where his neighbor, a nurse, patched me up. I sat there in shock, my mind replaying the night like a broken record. For years, I carried the guilt with me. A friend later sent me a newspaper clipping about Rodney's attempted murder of another girl, Tally Shapiro. That's when I realized the magnitude of what had happened and what could have happened if Mike hadn't broken that window. I survived, but I wasn't whole. Rodney Alcala had taken something from me that night, something I would never fully get back. Rodney Alcala, known as the Dating Game Killer, was a convicted serial killer and rapist who preyed on young women and girls in the 1970s. Among his countless victims, Morgan Rowan's name does not appear in the historical record or publicized cases tied to Alcala. Alcala, a photographer, used his charm and photography offers to lure victims, often exploiting their dreams of modeling. He was later convicted of multiple murders, including those of Robin Samso and others, and linked to additional unsolved cases through DNA. Alcala's chilling crimes highlighted the dangers of manipulation, ultimately leading to his death sentence and imprisonment.